The following presentation is a production of Capella University and is not intended for commercial use.
Here we are for the second Education Matters podcast. That is the name. We didn't have a name for the first very successful podcast, but we're going to call it the Education Matters podcast. It's not very clever, but we'll see if it flies. I'm Mike Buttry, Vice President for Public Affairs at Capella Education Company, and we're going to be joined by Sue Talley, our Dean of Technology, and we'll talk to Sue in a second. But it's an exciting week. We're back from the holidays. Everything's very busy. And Capella, I just learned yesterday that we got accepted into the Department of Education's experimental sites for FlexPath. And so we're going to get to do some exciting things. We'll talk more about FlexPath in this podcast and down the road at other times. But it's one of the innovative things going on here at Capella. And so it's been a good week. It's incredibly cold. That's the other thing that's going on right now in January in Minneapolis. But Sue Talley, welcome, and it's good to have you here.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here. I'm just also glad I'm not frozen.
Yes. We're going to talk about a lot of things that are going on with Capella around technology, but I wanted to start. I had an old boss who used to say, every person is writing their own book. And so I want to know a little bit about your book, right? Mm-hmm. Where are you from? How did you start out? And what's your story?
I started out in Iowa. I moved to Minnesota to attend McAllister College.
Wait, we have to go back already. Where in Iowa?
Oh, okay. Mason City.
Okay. So my folks are from Shenandoah, Iowa, yep. Down in the southwest corner.
Yes. As far away from Mason City as you can get.
Not quite.
It's not close. Mason City is 2 hours south of Minneapolis on 35W. I know well.
Near Clear Lake, right?
It is near Clear Lake.
Buddy Holly, Pat.
It's where Buddy Holly died. Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I grew up there. I came to Minnesota to go to college, McAllister College, and I was supposed to be a high school English teacher. So I studied English and psychology and education. And I started off as a high school English teacher, but I discovered about partway through my second year that we had this lab of computer terminals. And I wanted to make sure that my students who were studying things besides just regular English literature, I had a science fiction course, that we were able to take advantage of those computers. I'd done some things with computers at McAllister, and I thought that would be great. So I managed to weasel my way into the computer lab that was supposed to be only for the math teachers and got exposed to it. And after my third year of teaching high school English, I was looking in the paper for a dining room table to refinish over the summer. And because I had this habit of going through the want ads backwards, uh-huh. I saw this job posting for a job that was all about training other teachers how to use these computer terminals in their classes. And I thought, you know, that could be really cool. So it was during the summer. I applied. I got the job and never looked back. It was exciting. It was a great time. Minnesota was the first place to have a contract for buying Apple computers. So we were very early adopters here of technology. And because of that, I was exposed to a lot of people working in Silicon Valley and working with technology. So I decided to make the leap from working with technology with teachers here to go to work for Apple Computer. And that was really where I got my true grounding in technology and what it could do. And as Steve Jobs would say, how to change the world with technology. So
we have to take a detour here. Talk about the experience with Apple, right?
Sure.
It's probably the most iconic company maybe ever. What did you do? And what did you learn? And what was the culture like?
Great question. So I learned an immense amount. From Steve Jobs, there were some very key important things I learned. So one of the things I learned was if you were writing copy for anything in marketing, if you could substitute any other company's name for where you put Apple, then you hadn't written the sentence right. He believed that you had to know what your differentiation was and that you would always emphasize your differentiation. So when the Mac came out, the first Macintosh, he made the people revise the introductory brochure 38 times. Uh-huh. And he had a reputation for doing that. But I learned that that was really important and good, that you need to understand what your differentiation is. I also learned to be very nimble, that change was around us all the time, and there really weren't any right answers. Nobody knew what we were really supposed to be doing with these, especially in education, where You know, there hadn't been a lot of computers in classrooms before, so it was all new and different and fun to do new and different things, and exciting to be able to sort of make things up and try them out and see if they worked. So that was a lot of the culture where everybody really wanted to do something and everybody wanted to work together to do something. So it was an exciting place to work because there weren't really a lot of barriers to innovation or new things. It was really more that you had to do it and you had to come up with it.
Yeah.
I think one of the more amazing things that we had to do one year when Scully had fired Steve Jobs and we wanted to reintroduce.
I was just
going to
ask. I don't want to
date I was around during the firing of Steve. I call it the first era or the teenage years of Apple. One of the things that we ended up having to do, we wanted to relaunch this, and we needed a place that would hold a lot of people because we were going to invite people from across all of our industries where we sold the computers to. And they couldn't find a place in San Francisco that would hold them because we didn't start making the plans soon enough. So the people doing the event decided that we could hold it in a parking garage that wasn't finished yet.
Sure.
So they just put black draping in there and we could use the stairs and the elevators and everything. And we had all of our presentations on what would have been a floor in a parking garage. And I thought, now that sort of, you know, is iconic Apple of who else would decide that they're going to hold an event in a parking garage that's not quite finished
yet. I can
yet.
Just imagine Capella having an investor day
in a parking garage so that we could have enough room. So, you know, there were times like John Skelly was asked to come to Minnesota to speak, and he asked a few of us to come to his office to help him to figure out what his speech should be about. And I had been in Minnesota when Steve Jobs came to speak for the same conference. And I said, well, here's what worked. This is what Steve did. And so what they really want to know is about you. They don't really want to know anything about Apple or anything else. They want to know about you and your connections to all of this. So he said, I found out 2 days later, I got a call and it said, Sue, you're going to fly in the corporate jet to accompany John to Minnesota and help him work on the speech while you're on the plane and do all this stuff. And, you know, seeing the process that a CEO goes through. The other thing on the plane that was fun is that sandwiches were put on the plane and drinks. And John Skelly came from Pepsi. And I didn't really like Pepsi, and there was a Coke in the pan that they had, where they had all of the drinks on ice, and I looked at it, and he must have seen me looking at it, and he said, it's okay, Sue. You can have a Coke. I thought it would be a career-limiting move if I didn't want to drink Pepsi, and he said, no, it's fine. You can have the Coke. So there were a lot of things that I learned, but I think the two big ones were really how to deal with a culture of innovation that moves nimbly and quickly, a lot of people really wanting to work together, understanding that process is important, but it's often more important to be able to move fast. If we didn't move fast, we were going to become a commodity, and that was going to be a problem. And that was probably the biggest issue that we faced as I left Apple, that we were rapidly becoming a commodity, not something new and different, and you can't last for long.
So after Apple?
After Apple, the next big thing that I did, there are a couple of things in between as I was transitioning, but the next big thing I did is go back to school to get my doctorate, and I, of course, couldn't do it in the normal way. I decided that I really wanted to help create an online program, so I worked with some friends of mine who were already at Pepperdine in administrative positions, and I helped to create the doctoral program that I was going to go into. So while I was in the master's program, I helped to create an online doctoral program at Pepperdine. And I recruited a bunch of my friends to come for the first class. And after that was very successful, it continues to this day. So that was in 1990. We were working on it in 1995. It launched around that time.
It was launching at the same time Capella University
launched. Same time that Capella launched,
Just a couple years.
So we had a different approach to it, but we were also in the interesting space of doing online doctoral programs. At the time, we couldn't get approval for totally online, so we did. We still had some face-to-face meetings, but we did as much online as we could and still meet the accrediting body's requirements at that time.
So I want to come back to how kind of the road that led you to Capella University, but I think this is a really interesting idea. If you take yourself back to 1995 and the fact that you couldn't even get an online doctorate approved, to where we are in 2015, talk a little bit about the perception of online learning and how it's shifted over that course of time.
Right. I mean, online learning, when we first began it, was people thought that we couldn't possibly have any culture around online. It was going to take away from education, that people would get less of an education if you were going into online. There was a lot of proving that we were doing at least as well as the regular traditional education components. Pepperdine was interesting because we could do both. So we had campuses, so we were doing, I was teaching in other places as well, and then I was working with the online program. So the interesting thing is that they hired me after I graduated and finished my doctorate because they wanted to continue some of the things that we'd been trying, and we were able to convert the master's program to being almost totally online, three events during the year that people did, and the doctoral program also moved away from as much face-to-face as they'd been required to do. So quite a transition. I think when I realized that we might be on the real pathway to getting this done is the psychology students, everybody always thought it was a school of education and psychology. Everybody thought that the psychology students absolutely wouldn't go online. And when I heard that the psychology faculty talking about the fact that all of their students were finding Pepperdine by Googling us on the web, I knew that somehow we had reached this sort of transition point and that online education was okay.
Yep.
We also started getting students into the doctoral program from other traditional universities that didn't have doctoral programs yet, so friends at Harvard and some other institutions. And when we were starting to get students from there, I figured that we'd probably reached the point where it was acceptable.
Yep. So what brought you to Capella University?
Well, it was love, of course, that brought me back. My husband died, the one who I was with when I was at Apple, and I came back to Minnesota for a family gathering and ran into a friend from college, and sort of the rest was history. He was divorced at the time, and I was unmarried, and we got back together again. And over time, I was getting tired of flying from Minnesota to California and back again, and I said, okay, I think maybe I'm ready. And he said, oh, the winters have been really warm. It'll be fine. Global warming is warming up the winters, and you'll be fine and coming back. And so I gave in and came back and didn't fly back
How
and forth anymore.
For yeah.
There's only been a few times when I said, seriously, you said that it was going to be warmer? So last year when it was 50 below with wind chill, I might have said that a few times.
Yeah. It's a little different climate in Malibu.
Yeah, just a tidge different. It's okay. I just don't go outside a lot in the wintertime if I really am getting grumpy about it. So it has worked out really well. The way I got to Capella is I was still teaching for Pepperdine, but on a half-time basis. I decided that since I didn't want to fly back and forth quite so much, I'd do half-time. Well, anybody who's doing half-time thinks that, oh, I can do more.
Yep.
So I thought, well, I'll be an adjunct somewhere else. And I applied to be an adjunct at Capella. But I had to send my resume with it. And when they saw the resume, they said, oh, no, we want you for something else. So
good
I was,
for us.
Yeah, I was hired for a faculty director position, which was our equivalent of an associate dean. We eventually made that associate dean position. And then I became dean of technology 2 years ago. So.
Excellent.
That's my interesting pathway. I tell people that I've been in every flavor of education that you can have. So I've taught at public schools, I've taught at private schools, I've taught K through 12, I've taught higher ed, I've worked for a for-profit company that sells products into there, and now I'm at an online higher ed. Oh, and in between, sort of along the way to earn money, I worked for a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. So,
really?
Yes.
Which nonprofit?
National Center on Education and the Economy.
Okay.
Mark Tucker.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting. We're going to talk about that often.
Yeah. So it's been interesting because I got a chance over the course of my career and taking advantages of opportunities that came to me that I got a chance to always use my background in technology, but also focus on educating people about uses of technology.
So I want to talk a little bit now about your role as Dean of Technology. I want to talk about a couple of different topic areas. The first one is FlexPath.
Mm-hmm.
And for folks listening to this who don't know about FlexPath, I'll spare the long kind of tortured explanation, but it is a program that has been approved by the Higher Learning Commission and the Department of Education, where students, learners can go at their own pace. And we value not less the time that you spend with the material, but more the knowledge that you can demonstrate through an authentic assessment. It seems to me that as you look at different sectors in the economy, the IT sector thinks about people's qualifications differently than other sectors of the economy. And because of that, I think that an innovative degree like the FlexPath, it's the same degree, but an innovative path to a degree like the FlexPath path provides unique opportunity in this space. Can you talk a little bit about how FlexPath is, I think, especially important in IT?
I think the point about FlexPath and its differentiation in IT is, in IT, you could always get a job if you could prove that you had the skills. And the easy way for companies to know that you had the skills is for you to have a certification. So for a long time at Capella, we've given people credit for certifications that they had because they're very equivalent to the coursework that we set up for training people to be good in information assurance and security or project management. And we used the industry standard certificates to give people credit. And I think FlexPath is the next sort of step beyond that, where we still want to give people credit for what they already know. We don't want them to have to go back and learn it over again.
Yep.
I mean, I know that well because I went back to school to get my doctorate in my 40s. And, you know, I knew a lot already. And people kept saying to me, why are you going back to school? And I said, well, it's not so much that it's to necessarily learn new things. Yep. It's to have time to think about new things. And the learning space that I got by going back to get my doctorate was all about that.
And the price that you had to pay in order to do that was sitting through courses and instruction on stuff that you already knew and could demonstrate.
And often that I had helped to create because I was part of creating the program.
And not just sitting through it, but paying for it.
And paying a lot of money for it. So I understand completely. My master's degree was even worse, really, because I was teaching the course that I was petitioning. But rules were rules, and I said, okay, it's what you have to do to get there. This is a great way, I think, where we really allow people to show what they know and to give them the materials to work on things that they don't already know. It also changes the way you think about learning so that it goes back to sort of the earliest forms of learning where people are being formed by sort of a one-on-one relationship with the faculty member and the discussion about how to improve what you know or what you don't know and how to get to the point where you can be proficient. And there's a lot more feedback that's given, and that helps people who haven't yet mastered a skill or a knowledge or a behavior to be able to get to the point where they can demonstrate it.
Yep. I think one of the most exciting and interesting things over the next 2 years is going to be see how these flexible degree programs evolve and whether we can access a market of people today who are looking for a degree, but there are barriers because of lack of flexibility around time and cost.
And the other barrier, I think, often is as more people are trained to do something, then we just up the ante. And so when there were enough people in IT, then we said, okay, you have to have a bachelor's degree. And then the next thing was that in order to be a manager, you had to have a master's degree. So I think part of, especially now when we don't have enough IT people in a lot of places, we have to look closely at what we really need to do to create the workforce that's needed. And that may not always be a degree program, and we have to understand when it's a degree program, what we do differently in degree programs than what you do in things that today are called badges or certificates or certifications or other things. Sometimes that's enough, and that's exactly what they need in the workplace. Sometimes it's not enough. And I like to say that what we do in degree programs is really work on open-ended, complex problems that don't have a right answer.
Yep.
And we try to create the courses so that they have that kind of project assessment in it. And that's what you do in real life. That's often not what you do in training courses.
Yeah. And that is, I think that's a really important point because it's very easy. So competency-based education and direct assessment programs like FlexPath are kind of the flavor of the month. But the conversation around them can sometimes become very quickly reductionist. Mm-hmm. And it starts to sound like a training program.
Mm-hmm.
What you just described, you can't solve an open-ended, complex problem that doesn't necessarily have a one answer without grounding in theory.
Right.
And being able to apply and work that theory. It is far more than a training program. But that doesn't mean that you can't still measure knowledge and assess it.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that Capella is really good at is understanding how to do that assessment. and we're getting better at it. Yep. There are lots of things that we could do better, but I think that the one thing that we really have forced ourselves to really learn and understand is how to do a competency so that we know we can measure it, we know what we're looking for, and we can write a scoring rubric with performance levels in it that will guide the people who are doing the assessments and have a little less subjectivity, a little bit more grounding in what you're really looking for. I think the part where we probably need to move to is understanding how to state those competencies in more workplace language. Because we've had to get approvals from education bodies, we've always had to write these with a lot of education ease. And the next path that I see is that I think we need to move to stating those in ways that the student who's coming in, the learner who's coming in, really understands it and understands what we're looking for. And
can articulate back to the employer.
Yep. And then it makes sense also to the workplace that they're going back into. So when we can get to the point where we can jive what their competencies or expectations are with sort of what we're creating for people, and still adding that theory component. I've worked for a long time with corporate partners between Apple and Capella, and I think, you know, they always come back and say, what we want are people who can think critically, who can write well, and, you know, who can solve these problems for us, and who can be good managers or leaders. And you don't necessarily get that just by doing skills-based training. You have to do some of the application and the thinking and working through some things, learning how to work with your peers in a virtual environment. Lots of things that I think we can do in spades and can work with the companies to be able to do.
This is exciting. You mentioned the lack of IT professionals globally, but domestically, right? We have a skills gap and we don't have enough IT professionals in the United States. At the same time, you open the Wall Street Journal, open Wired Magazine, whatever it is, and you can't escape the fact that women are severely underrepresented as a percentage of what they are in the population, severely underrepresented in the IT space. Just from a personal perspective, my wife was a 7th and 8th grade math and science teacher, and it drove her crazy because in that 7th and 8th grade time range is when she would see girls start pulling away from math and science. You've had this, which we just chronicled, this non-traditional path into the IT space of breaking into the computer lab and making it available to your students when you're teaching English. Talk a little bit about why you think that is, and then as Dean of Technology at Capella University, how do we think about that in terms of how we serve learners, but especially female learners in the tech space?
I think that the pathway has been limited for women for a long time because culturally they were told that they couldn't do mathematics. And even though I knew I really could do math and did well in high school, my choice was to go into English literature because I could also do that.
Yep.
And it was a much easier path. But I think I found myself always wanting to use that other part of my thinking and brain and integrating that. And for a lot of other women, they're very good at IT, but they just didn't like math. It wasn't their thing. But if you ask them about it, so two of my faculty chairs are women, and if you ask them about it, they will say, but I like to take things apart, or I like to figure out how to solve a problem. And really, that's what technology is all about at the base. It's not necessarily mathematical. It's really figuring out how to solve a problem. If Google uses algorithms to figure out how best to serve people, the algorithm is really a way of thinking about a logic for solving the problem of figuring out who to send that one piece to. And I think when women are asked to solve or create solutions to problems, that's when we're at our best, and why sometimes we can be better at some jobs than men, because we bring a different perspective about the problem, we think through things a little differently, and that's helpful in the workplace. There's a lot of literature that shows that the more diversity you have, the more women that you have, the better the problem solving, the better the products, because of that diversity of perspective. You're more likely to take into account the different needs of the different customers that you're going to serve. So the one pet peeve I have that I see going on now is the movement thinks that the way to get women into technology is to teach them how to code when they're in middle school. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that coding is really the problem. I think it's really that you need to let women participate with the teenage girls, participate with guys and their friends in problem-solving exercises as opposed to specifically coding. Coding is like a symbol of what you need, but it really isn't the end result. Most people in technology don't code. And so it's a...
And you can always learn it.
That's right. You can learn it. Yeah. I mean, all of the women who work for me as faculty chairs all learned how to code, but they don't like math. So I think that we, and their parents often didn't know that these jobs were available. They didn't support women going into them. Google did a study that talked about the fact that one of the real problem areas was that none of their teachers or their parents knew enough about the opportunities in the field to promote them to women.
Yep.
So there are lots of opportunities. Big data is an incredible area that women can be very, very good at. Lots of women are very strong in the analytics field, and it's a huge need. So we need to appeal to women to fill the need of data at the moment and data analysis. We also need women in the field of information assurance and security. And sometimes that's a little bit tougher for them to break into. But again, a lot of the skills that women have could be very helpful in making sure that there's sort of a different way of looking at how you make something secure. A lot of security is about people behaviors, not about trying to harden your system so much that nobody can get in. Yeah. It's about the people who figure out how to either leak something or allow something in. And so it's really more about people behaviors that you need to understand. And that's where, again, diversity of opinion and the addition of women into the workforce would be very helpful.
Yep. So you've been very generous with your time. I've enjoyed this. I want to leave on this. As an adult learner yourself, and you think about our population of adult learners coming to us, Capella, the average student is 40.
Sure. Which I was.
Yep. What is your advice to them? Because there are so many tools that exist today and so much opportunity to get education, but at the same time, it is a challenge to balance education with real life. And what is your advice? And if you had a learner sitting in front of you, what would you tell them?
I think there are two things. One of the most important things, I think, is to find friends in the program. If you can find somebody else who you can lean on, you can vent to, you can work with, often they'll have a skill that you don't have, and that will supplement yours, whereas you have a skill that they don't have. I think that that's a big key to being successful when you're older. The joke in my doctoral program, we had, by the way, only one person didn't finish out of our entire first class.
That's remarkable.
It is. And when we got to the doctoral phase where you sort of all go off and do your own thing, when we graduated, there was a Barbie doll in a graduation outfit that got passed around. So that was sort of the token prize that you got, which you would think wouldn't mean very much, but it meant a lot to the people getting it. And to say, okay, so I finally made it into the club of people who got the graduation Barbie doll. And it's that community feeling that I think helps you get through the really tough times, the times when you say, oh God, you know, I can't study another hour, I can't write another paper, I can't stay up another late hour at night trying to finish my final piece. And the other thing is that as an adult, you're really there to learn, not to get a grade.
Yep.
So yes, it might make a difference if you want to go on to from master's degree into a doctorate or from bachelor's into master's. But what's more important, because you're probably working and you're trying to get ahead, what's more important is that you really learn what you're getting. And that if you feel you're not learning, you need to speak up and ask questions and probe a bit, because what we're really all about is helping people to learn enough to be better at their jobs, to think more critically about things. And sometimes working for the grade gets in the way. Yep. And it's not really what you're about as an adult. Yep. It was really hard for my friends in the doctoral program to give up getting a grade. And I said, but there's nowhere else for us to go after this. Who's going to look at the grades?
Yep.
But it took us a long time to get over that feeling that, yes, you have to, you know, do every I and cross every T, because, you know, what's really most important is if you're satisfied and it's good learning for you, then that's fine. And do what you can do with the life that you have and try to make it work.
This is great. Thanks for doing it. Anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover?
There's only one thing I want to talk about, and that's I want to toot our horn a little bit at Capella, because I don't think we realized in the technology programs that we actually have a higher percentage of women than probably most programs in the country have. So we have between 35 and 40% female population demographic out of our programs. Most of the programs in the country are struggling to have 10 or 20%. Yeah. And, you know, I think this is great. I can't say that we did this intentionally, yeah. but I think it comes out of what we try to do at Capella in terms of support and understanding what it takes to be an adult learner. And something I just read today said that women are more likely to take a longer time to go through school because of the fact that they're usually the caregivers for children, and often they're single mothers. And I think there are times when Capella maybe better recognizes that. We have much more we should be doing to recognize that and to support, but I think that's when I look at diversity and concerns, I think we need to understand what the real life problems are and what we can do to help so they don't get in the way of the learning process.
I think you're right. You know, we market to adult learners. We don't market to men or women, but our ability to, at our best, meet people where they live, I think it speaks to what you were just talking about,
right.
and your leadership is a huge part of that. So thanks.
Well, thank you, but I think that there's a lot of people who have paved the way. Now I really do want to try to provide some leadership to make sure that we support the women that we have. I went for a long time, you know, fighting about the fact that we were different because we had 60% men and 40% women, and the usual demographic at Capella is exactly the opposite.
Yes.
But now I realize that the 40% women is actually a great thing.
Pretty extraordinary.
And it's extraordinary, and we should be talking about it and understanding it more. So hopefully I can do more of that.
Great. Well, thank you for being on the second podcast. We'll have to have you on like the 12th or something.
Okay.
It's
a deal.
All right.
I agree.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
This presentation has been brought to you by Capella University and may not be redistributed or used for any commercial purpose without the expressed written consent of Capella University.